Aunt Sally said. When my moms got home, she held my right arm up in the air and whooped me like a slave with a plastic laundry line. The same cord girls used to jump rope. Yow! I hopped around trying to block the hits. When she finished, welts burnt all over my legs and ass. I didn't shoplift again for a long time. That Easter, my mom's brother and I went to Nana's crib in Ravenswood Projects. Nana, my mother's mother, Miss Bernie Johnson, was a heavy-set, high yellow woman with hazel green eyes like my mother's. Nana chain-smoked cigarettes and worked as a token booth clerk at the train station on Jackson Avenue in Long Island City. A sweet lady who spoke with a classic nasal New York accent. Her apartment in Ravenswood looked like a souvenir store because Nana traveled the world collecting trinkets. Her favorite possessions were her Jet magazines, every issue stacked on the coffee table. My favorite thing to do at Nana's crib was climb the big Central Park looking rocks in front of her building. Nana and I would toss shell peanuts down to the squirrels on those rocks and watch them pounce. Besides her token booth job, Nana had a side hustle selling bottles of imitation perfume and cologne at the beauty salons in Long Island City. The boxes for those bottles would read, "If you like Ralph Lauren, then you'll love Rudolph Llorente." But the knockoff smelled just like the real thing. My favorites were the fake Dracar and gray flannel. Nana had me smelling good for school. Uncle Charlie, my mother's brother, who came back from the Vietnam War mentally messed up, traveled from the VA hospital upstate New York to Nana's for the holidays and always brought me a big black garbage bag full of model army planes, tanks, and trucks. There were 90 pieces to glue together, put stickers on, and paint. I was too young and impatient, so I never completed one of those things. The highlight of going to Nana's crib was her fried chicken wings, the best in black history. Salty like a motherfucker, but amazingly good. The summer of 1986 was a wild one. A lot of older dudes were getting murdered in Left Rack over drug wars. Guns were easier to get than ever. The hoods became more violent, and the streets of New York began to change. The following September, my moms transferred me to a Lutheran school on Queens Boulevard near Left Rack. She realized that I was being influenced towards. Guns were easier to get than ever. The hoods became more violent, and the streets of New York began to change. The following September, my moms transferred me to a Lutheran school on Queens Boulevard near Left Rack. She realized that I was being influenced by my environment after seeing that bag of weapons I'd been going to school with. We had to wear uniforms, a white button-down shirt, clip-on tie, blazer, shoes, and slacks. I was embarrassed to walk home in my uniform while the public school kids wore regular clothes. I started acting up even more after school to prove to my friends in the hood that I was still cool. When Halloween came around, 15 of us ran around Left Rack wilding after dark, egging and breaking car windows, slapping innocent people with socks filled with baby powder. A cop rolled by inside a three-wheel scooter car. We egged him and ran across the bridge that crossed the Long Island Expressway while a cop chased us in a little scooter. We got to the top of the bridge and all looked at each other like, "Why are we running?" We turned around, surrounded the scooter, shook it back and forth until it tipped over, then jetted back to Left Rack. I wasn't trying to be on punishment again, so I ran home, fast, without looking back. My birthday was major that November because I turned 13. Moms and grandmas gave me a Genesis turntable, headphones, a speaker, and cash to buy some records. A month later, I got another turntable, mic, and a mixer for Christmas. I started making my own mixtapes, rapping and blending records like Two Shorts, Freaky Tales, and Biz Marquee's Nobody Beats the Biz. 2 years flew by at that Lutheran school. The classes were small, so the work was easy to learn. But the uniform sucked. I couldn't wait for it to be over. The summer after junior high school graduation, I wanted to get a tattoo like the flying parachute my father had on his left forearm, an airborne tat from his paratrooper days. Before I was born, he was a Special Forces Green Beret in the Army who went on several POW rescue missions. I brought my fake ID to the tattoo shop in Long Island across from the Belmont racetrack. The heavyset, gray-bearded guy behind the counter who looked like Jerry Garcia from The Grateful Dead laughed and told me to come back when I turned 18. During a trip to Virginia to visit my cousins on my pop's side of the family a few months later, I found a tattoo shop that didn't care that I was 13 and gave me my first tattoo for $30, a Tasmanian devil on my right shoulder. Back in New York, I was one of the only kids my age with a tattoo, so I rolled up my t-shirt on the right side so everybody can see. My second tattoo was a skeleton swinging from barbed wire on my right bicep. I only wanted tattoos because Pops had them. When I showed Moms, she almost had a heart attack. She worried that they would affect my sickle cell, but they didn't. I got 3 tats that summer. The third one was a dragon that I saw on the tattoo parlor wall, and I thought that it would look cool on my right hand. I was a crazy little kid. I blamed sickle cell and my father. A month later, I had to go to the hospital for 2 days. Back home, depressed and fed up with the pain, God, the world, and myself, I wanted to commit suicide because of my sickle cell. I tied a rope around my closet pole and tried hanging myself, but it didn't feel too good. I wanted to end pain, not create more. So I scratched that plan. My next idea was to slit my wrist. The sharpest knife I could find in the house was a steak knife with a brown wooden handle. I took it into my room and started cutting my wrist, but that hurt too. Suicide was too damn painful. Moms walked into my room while I was on the closet floor looking crazy with a steak knife in my hand and a noose on my closet pole. "What the hell are you doing?" she asked. I told her I wanted to kill myself because I was tired of sickle cell. She spoke to me for a few hours trying to make me feel better. Moms brought me to a psychiatrist, Dr. Z, on Queens Boulevard the next day. I ain't want to talk to no damn shrink, but Moms insisted. My first day, I didn't speak much. I ran through his glass bowl of candy every appointment. We spoke about my sickle cell pain, and he tried to convince me that all would be well. Yeah, whatever. I tried 4 appointments and told my Moms it wasn't worth the money. I wasn't planning on following through with my suicide anyway. I'd rather live. I was glad that I didn't have to go back to that shrink's office because I didn't like people in my business. Never did, never will. This book is a damn miracle. I never thought that I would be writing my life story, but once I started getting it all down, I realized it could help inspire others to do great things with their own lives. So here it is. I'm sharing, damn it. Towards the end of that summer, a bunch of my friends from my block were talking about what high school they wanted to go to in September. Most of them were saying the High School of Art and Design. Some of them were saying John Baum. Art and Design was a prestigious art school in Manhattan. They said in order to get in, we would have to take an art test and bring a portfolio showcasing our artwork. I bought white t-shirts and airbrush paint and made my own version of the Graffiti Crew, the Shirt Kings, airbrush t-shirts with Louis Vuitton and Gucci logos for my portfolio. I figured that the white people at the school had never seen anything like that before and would be impressed. It was worth a try. I really didn't give a fuck about school. I already made my mind up to be a rapper. I just wanted to be with my homies from Left Rack. Little did I know, I wouldn't even be hanging with them anymore. I was about to meet a whole new set of friends with whom I would change the course of the world. Chapter 2. Poetical Prophets. The first day of high school is one of the most important days of a teenager's life. I spent the entire summer of 1989 getting prepared. I'm 15 years old now, so I have to step it up. The hottest gear out was Fila, Nautica, Polo, Benetton, and Banana Republic, plus Guess and Jabro jeans. I did a Jux, a robbery, with my boy Stobo to get the money. I had it all. My idea for the imitation Shirt King shirts worked. I was accepted into art and design. The school had students from every borough. I thought my grandma's school had some bad girls. Art and design was a gold mine of dimes. The first few days, I didn't see anybody from Left Rack, but I made a new friend, Derek from the Bronx, in my photography class. His mother worked for the radio station WBLS, and he had a lot of information about the music industry. We sat at the same lunch table every day. Lunch was where it all went down. People at one table in a rap cipher, a kid Terrence giving $5 haircuts, drugs and guns being sold in the bathroom, and random robberies taking place all over. Lunch was like the yard in prison. Around that time, I was shopping my first demo for a record deal. My mother was my manager, since she knew the ropes of the business. I was going by the name Lord T, the Golden Child, after Eddie Murphy's movie, The Golden Child. After shopping at a few companies throughout the summer, we inked a demo deal with Jive Records, just as school started in September. Jive agreed to pay for my studio time. If I came up with enough good songs, they'd offer me a real contract. It was like a trial. Even though it was almost nothing, it felt like something to me. It was a start. I flirted with the women at Jive, and one of them, Kim, a good-looking, heavy-set black woman, got me on the soundtrack for a movie coming out that summer called Boys in the Hood. They let me open up the song Too Young by R&B group High Five with 16 bars. After that first break, Jive wanted to sign me up for a real contract. At school the next day, I told Derek about the deal.
"You should meet my man Havoc," he said as we dipped photos in a solution in the darkroom during photography class. "He's a rapper too. You should partner up because y'all both the same height and have a similar style." After school, I waited outside for Derek to introduce me to Havoc. A crowd of people came running out the front door. A short kid about my height was getting ready to fight a taller dude. Derek walked up.
"That's Havoc right there about to fight," he said.
The tall kid pulled out a knife and tried stabbing Havoc in his stomach, missing by inches. A few people in the crowd rushed over and took the knife. Havoc proceeded to beat the shit out of the dude.
"Kiwi, Kiwi, Kiwi,"
the crowd chanted Havoc's nickname, lifting him up into the air and carrying him all the way to the train station.
"Kiwi, Kiwi, Kiwi."
I followed Derek and Havoc onto the train, and Derek introduced us. "Nice fighting," I told Havoc.
"Did you see when he tried to stab me?"
Hav asked. We rode to Queens Plaza,
making small talk about Queensbridge and the music industry. We spit some verses back and forth as we walked to Ravenswood, where Hav's grandmother lived. I told him how ironic it was that my nana lived in Ravenswood, too. He told me how this rapper from Queensbridge named Tragedy was his mentor and gave him his name, Havoc. I told him about my situation at Jive and that I was going to try to include him in the deal. The next day at school, Havoc snuck his way into our lunch period. "Yo, Hav and I going to Jive after school," I told Derek. "You should come." Before my next class, I went to the bathroom wearing a bunch of new bracelets and rings looking like Slick Rick. A dude followed me into the bathroom. "This nigga scheming?" I sensed that right away. He had some big rings on himself. One with a big Scorpio symbol stood out because that's my birth sign. I felt his eyes on my jewelry. Nothing happened, but after that, I bought a 22 Dillinger with a pearl handle and a bunch of bullets from this kid selling guns in the school cafeteria. I admired Slick Rick for his jewelry and how he shot his cousin who tried to rob him. I thought to myself, I'm going out like Slick Rick. Later that day, I arrived at Jive before Havoc. I was really feeling the idea of us being partners and decided that if they wanted to sign me, they were going to have to sign Hav too. I sat down with the A&R. "Look, I got a partner now, and things have changed," I told him. He responded that Jive just wanted to sign me. They weren't interested in my partner. Hav showed up and spit for the A&R, but the guy didn't change his mind. So I turned down the deal and never came back. My mom was upset, but ultimately let me do what I wanted. They kept me on the Boys in the Hood soundtrack, so it wasn't a total loss. Havoc, Derek, and I hung out together every day. Havoc had his lunch period switched so we could kick it even more. I started going to Ravenswood with Hav after school to work on song ideas. I met his younger brother, TJ, and their cousin, Todd. Todd was a real smart kid when it came to school. He was also into photography. So he told Hav and me that he would take some demo pictures for us. Hav started bringing me 3 blocks over to Queensbridge Projects to hang out with his friends. He bugged out when I told him I used to be in QB every day because my mom's worked for housing. It had been years since I've been to QB. And who's the first person I saw? The kid who had me up against the wall for talking to his girl. His name was Deaky, a.k.a. Nice. And he's one of Hav's boys. He ain't even remember me. I also saw some of my old friends from Reese Day Camp. They remember me right away. Havoc, his boys, my old friends, and I sat on the benches on Hav's block and reminisced about old times while drinking 40 ounces. There was a party going down later that night in the projects. The energy at the block party behind Reese Center that night was intense. Ice grills, screw faces, weed smoke, and hard liquor. Party was in a park, enclosed by a tall black steel gate with sharp tips on it, with only one way in and one way out. Everybody was standing around trying to look tough, smoking, drinking, bobbing our heads to the music. Something was going to pop off at any moment. About an hour into the party, it did. This rapper from QB, who was unknown at the time, named Nasty Nas, had a younger brother named Jungle. Jungle got into an argument with somebody, and gunshots started flying. Everybody ran to the exit, or hit the deck. Hav and I, and the 2 chicks we were with, ran and hopped the gate. My pants got hooked on one of the sharp tips. I was hanging upside down, yelling for Hav to get me off the gate. My shots were flying. Hav and one of the chicks, Jessica, darted back. And by the time they ripped me down, my jeans were shredded, torn open like those NBA pants with the buttons down the sides. If Jessica's reading this, I know she's dying laughing right now. That was my first Queensbridge block party, and the first time that I had bullets whizzing around me. I guess you could say I was hooked on QB from then on. Hav and I bonded real quickly and decided that music was more important to us than school. We went to school just to check in for homeroom attendance, met in the cafeteria, and cut out after lunch. Most of the time, we'd jump out of the lunchroom window since it was on the first floor. Sometimes we'd linger by the front door and run when the security guard wasn't looking. A lot of times, we go to school just to rob people for their clothes, money, Walkman, train and bus passes, and anything else worth taking. One Thursday, Havoc and I cut out of school to meet two girls at his grandmother's crib in Ravenswood. When we got there, Hav's brother TJ and their three friends from Queensbridge, the twins and Nitty, were already at the crib cutting school as well. The twins, Nitty, and TJ, who were all a few years younger than Havoc and I, said they were on their way to catch some juxes. Hav pulled out a small fruit cup snack from out the freezer. "You check this out, P," he said. "You gotta get them nice and cold, then pour a little on Shorty's clit and lick it off. They go crazy, son, I'm telling you." Yeah, that nigga has a freak. I had never given a girl head before, but that cold fruit cup thing had me ready to try it. The girls came through and we went into different rooms for privacy. Nothing happened with me and the girl I was with. Then TJ and the twins came back sweaty and out of breath with a mini color TV and other electronics. The guy they robbed had started shooting at them. One of the twins was shot in the leg and went back to QB for help. When Havy finished up with his shorty, we walked the girls to the train and then I went home. I took an instant liking to Havoc and his boys because they were into the same criminal risk-taking that I was into. I was sort of living a double life, taking the bus and train to school during the week to make my moms happy, then on the weekends, going to parties, having sex, drinking, using all kinds of drugs, and doing stick-ups. We'd rob anybody that looked flashy, even people who didn't. Most of the time, the non-flashy ones were the ones with the money. In Queensbridge, we would have knockout contests to see who could knock out a crackhead with one punch. We hung out on the walkway on the 59th Street Bridge and robbed people who walked and rode their bikes across, beat up cab drivers for their money, and whatever wasn't cash, we took to the pawn shops on Sufton Boulevard in Jamaica. When the money ran out, I was right back to being broke, robbing people for petty shit. At school one afternoon, I saw this new kid with a dope gray hooded polo jacket with polo in big blue letters across the chest. So Hav, Derek, and I follow him to the train station after school. I jumped in front of him and threw a wild punch, but instead of hitting his jaw, I hit his forehead and broke my hand. It probably hurt me more than it hurt the kid. I fell back while Havoc and Derek robbed him. My Uncle Lenny had just gotten his hands on a $10 million brownstone on 92nd Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan. Uncle Lenny had a lot of mafia connections and said somebody owed him a favor, so they let him live there for a few years. My grandmother never trusted Lenny. She told me, "If you let Lenny in your house, he'll leave with your TV and you won't even realize it." Lenny told me a lot about street shit. He knew how to manipulate and use people. He taught me the mental part of the game. My pops taught me the physical. I hope he doesn't get upset with me for sharing this, but my Uncle Lenny is gay. He doesn't show it at all. There's no reason you should treat a person foul because they're gay. After I broke my hand on that kid's forehead, Havoc and I took the train to Uncle Lenny's brownstone. I showed my swollen hand to Lenny, and he told me it was broken. One of Lenny's friends stopped by while we were there, an older Italian man who was a retired boxer. He looked at my hand and confirmed that it was broken, or what's called a boxer's fracture. I saw a lot of tough mafia guys around Lenny, who I knew were his friends. Uncle Lenny told me that he managed gay bars all over New York City for the mafia. After checking out my hand, Lenny made Hav and me some pasta and we left. I took the train to Mom's job down by the World Trade Center. She had become a high-ranking employee at the New York City Housing Authority and no longer had to work in the projects. When I got to her office on Murray Street in Broadway, Mom's left early and took me to St. Vincent's Hospital. The doctor told me I had a hairline fracture and my pinky knuckle was out of the socket. A boxer's fracture, just like Uncle Lenny's friend had said. The doctor pulled my knuckle back into place, wrapped my hand in a small cast, and told me it would ache later in life. At school the next day, our boy Tafari from Coney Island took a photo of Havoc and me laughing about the situation in the lunchroom, my arm in a sling. It's a classic. Tafari knew this kid named Silver in Coney Island who had a small studio. And Havoc and I cut out of school every day and rode the D train for an hour from Manhattan to Silver's crib. In 1 month, we made like 50 songs at Silver's. I did a couple of robberies and got $20,000. Thinking back, I regret it. In time, I paid for every red cent I stole and for every person who got hurt along the way. Karma is very real. Anyway, I got the bread, and at the Coliseum Mall next to Jamaica Avenue, I bought Havoc a big gold link and a Mary Mother of God pendant with a big ruby in it. Hav was happy. I bought myself a thick herringbone chain with the biggest Nefertiti piece that they had, plus 3 gold rings. Hav told me about the Steinway Street shopping area in Astoria, so we went on a shopping spree, spending about $700 on clothes and sneakers. My 15th birthday had just passed, so I decided it was time to start driving. At a used car lot on Hillside Avenue in Jamaica, Queens, I bought my first car for $9,000 cash, a Sterling luxury car imported from England. I was 15 with no license, insurance, nothing. But the used car dealer was so grimy and happy that I had cash, he gave me a temporary registration and said to come back when it expired and he'd give me a new one. I was the littlest motherfucker with big jewelry, the flyest clothes, and a nice car. Since I didn't have a license and looked so young, I had tints put on the windows and mostly drove it at night or on the weekends I spent at Grandma's crib. Back then, people were still walking around with beepers on their hips. And if you were lucky enough to have a cell phone, which was damn near unheard of, it was big and doofy. Car washers sold fake plastic car phones with antennas to stick on your windshield. I bought one and pretended like I was on the phone when I drive past girls. Don't laugh, I got a lot of girls with that trick. I'd park a couple of blocks away or around the corner from my crib so my moms and grandmoms didn't know I had a car. $9,000 was stashed, left untouched. Almost all the biggest rappers talk about how they were getting money since back in the day. But I guarantee you, none of them was doing what I was doing at 14 and 15. Anybody who knew me from back then can vouch for me. One Saturday, Havoc came to my grandma's dance school.
Is it like this every Saturday?
Havoc asked me. He was open and bagged a few girls from there.
I've got to start coming here more often.
That weekend, I found out that cousin Craig had got locked up again. Somehow he'd been shot in the foot, and they locked him up right after that. Havoc and Stobo spent the weekend at my grandma's crib in Hempstead. We drove